What a year this week has been.
If you are smuggling a child, then we will prosecute you. And that child may be separated from you.
The United States should be better than this.
What people are forgetting, they just want to listen to those tapes. You know, I can take you to any nursery and you're going to hear the exact same things.
Essentially, summer camps.
Very large cages.
Held against their will, tin foils for comfort blankets.
Unsanitary conditions. Un-air-conditioned rooms. Dosing children with mood-changing drugs, allegedly disguised as vitamins.
We are enforcing the laws passed by Congress.
We call on you to end family separation.
A girl with Down syndrome taken from her mother and put in a cage. I read about a did you say want to a
hidden away from public view. What country is that?
The number of families that are they're opposing as families has quadrupled, crying to cross our borders.
I would like to see some evidence of that.
Like to ask you how I can help.
Jacket said on the back, I really don't care. Do you?
Three tender age shelters in South Texas. Lawyers and medical providers. Just think I'm gonna have to hand this off.
The president is either not knowing, not caring, delusional, and denial.
President Trump is doing is he's securing the border just like he said he would do.
Too many criminals by the hundreds of thousands coming to this country every year.
By the way, today I signed an executive order. We're going to keep families together, but the border is going to be just as tough as it's been.
And the American people don't like the idea that we're separating families. We never really intended to do that.
If you are smuggling a child, then we will prosecute you. And that child may be separated from you.
After announcing a zero tolerance at the border and the forced separation of children from their parents, outrage grew from the media, from the public, and from politicians on both sides of the aisle. The administration was all over the place, too. Some in the White House called it a deterrent, a way to show others what would happen if they tried to cross illegally. Others argued they were just simply following the law. The administration called it a new Justice Department policy, then said it wasn't a policy at all. Trump said only Congress could fix it, but then the president, with the stroke of a pen, reversed the decision, but still allowed children to be detained just with their parents. Meanwhile, House Republicans, divided over legislation that would address the separation of families, as well as the fate of DACA and funding for the border wall, spent the week struggling to find the votes to pass a bill. I'm Amy Walter, and this is The Takeaway. This week, my colleague Tanzina Vega brought us the stories and the voices from the front lines of the immigration debate. Today, we look at the Republican and Democratic strategy on an issue that's divided the parties and the nation, and find out how it may impact the 2018 election. Here with me to help kick things off is Lisa Desjardins, correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, and Elise Foley, who covers politics and immigration for HuffPost. Welcome.
Hello. Great to be here.
Hello.
Elise, I'm looking at you, so you can answer this first, and then Lisa, jump in. So we started the week with the administration standing firm on the policy of zero tolerance, saying over and over again, we aren't backing down. And by the end of the week, it looks like they did back down, and an executive order has been signed. So is this it? Is this done? We don't have this policy anymore?
I don't think so. So what they kind of did was they subbed out part of the zero tolerance policy, which is the family separations, for something else, which is family detention. So what they want now, what the executive order calls for, is to detain the families together, not separate them. They're going to have to probably fight in court for this.
Yeah, why is that?
That's because there's this settlement. It's from 1997 about the treatment of kids in detention, and it has a bunch of requirements. One of them is about the length of detention. In 2015, when the Obama administration tried to expand family detention, they were blocked and not allowed to hold kids for more than about 20 days. And so that's why the government currently doesn't detain families, immigrant families, for more than about 20 days in most situations. That's why the Trump administration previously said that they had to separate families. So now they're going to be up against this. It's kind of unclear what's going to happen. They've asked in court for a change to that. But I think it's possible that they, you know, start separating families again. and say that this is the court's fault.
Do you agree with that, Lisa, that we are going to see the family separation issue continue and that the executive order, while it may have had a short-term impact, isn't going to have a longer-term role in all of this?
I think we don't even know if families are being detained together yet, because the administration said, while this executive order technically went into effect immediately when the president signed it, they also said there's an implementation phase during which the agencies involved, primarily Border and Protection and then HHS, have time where they need to work out exactly how they're changing their policy. And what we know from a flurry of reports from many outlets in the last 2 days is there is widespread confusion among these agencies as to whether adults are still being prosecuted and therefore families separated or not. In the meanwhile, the separated families also looks like we're hearing more and more that it is going to be very difficult for them to reunify because the agencies involved did not always document when kids were with a parent, when they weren't, and now these children are all over the country. There is incredible confusion about the policy now, the policy in 20 days, and then what happens to the kids who've already been affected.
So at least Congress was theoretically going to help with answering some of these questions that Lisa brought up. But one bill that was brought up was defeated. And now Republicans saying a so-called compromise bill, this is a compromise within the Republican conference, not a bipartisan compromise bill. They also don't have the votes, and they are going to wait until next week, potentially, to bring up this issue. So can you talk to us a little bit about what Congress is trying to do and why they can or can't address this legislatively?
So it would be a little bit easier, according to some legal experts, for Congress to step in and change the standards, the requirements for family immigration detention. That would be something that would be less likely maybe to be challenged in court. It probably would be challenged in court, but it might be more likely to win than the president doing it on its own. So that's what he wants them to do. I think it's important to remember with these two bills that they are far beyond the family separation. I mean, these are not family separation prevention bills.
And wasn't this also driven not by the family separation issue, but by moderates on the Republican side who wanted to deal with the DACA situation? So they were bringing up this issue before we even had the controversy at the border.
Yeah, this all far predates that. Yeah. This all probably would have happened regardless. Now there's kind of this reframing to say these bills are addressing family separation, which I think the idea partially is to put more pressure on Democrats. Like, why won't you support our bills to keep families together? The problem is that given all of the things in these bills, it's really hard to pass them. It's just the same mess that we've seen on immigration over and over.
And adding to that mess slash confusion, Lisa, here's a tweet from President Trump. Republicans should stop wasting their time on immigration until after we elect more senators and congressmen, women in November. Dems are just playing games. They have no intention of doing anything to solve this decades-old problem. We can pass great legislation after the red wave. So hold on a minute. I thought the president said Congress alone can fix this. They need to do their job. Now the president saying, well, Congress should just stop wasting their time. What is going on?
Right. He also tweeted, what is the purpose of the House doing good immigration bills when you need 9 votes by Democrats in the Senate? So he's obviously thinking a little bit about the end game. As he talks about the true problems that anything has in the Senate, he's completely undermining what Speaker Paul Ryan is putting every last ounce of his energy into, trying to get something done on immigration in the House. And that tweet clearly had impact, Amy, on members of the House. I talked to members of the House as they walked out of that first vote, the more conservative bill that failed. And conservatives actually felt emboldened because, number one, there were more Republicans voting for that conservative bill than we had expected. It still failed, still does not have enough by quite a bit, but it has more support than expected. And second of all, they think what the president is doing is trying to help move the ball to the right. Who knows what he's really doing? But that is, I think, one of the reasons we saw the delay on this compromise until next week, because conservatives suddenly feel emboldened. Meanwhile, there's a lot to be said about that vote, because the 41 members who voted no, they are the ones to watch. And Amy, it's a map of people who think they are vulnerable. And on that map, among those no votes, Kathy McMorris Rogers, one of the leaders of the House. So it's not just the names you hear of a lot. What you have is conservatives who have been worried about primary challenges moving more to the right, and then you see some moderates worried about the general election who are now moving toward the middle. And as Elise was saying, this is a problem for passing anything.
I want to just take us backwards just for a minute here. We've been spending a lot of time focusing on the Trump administration's policy is the zero tolerance policy. But some of the policies that are under scrutiny right now, Lisa, like what to do with unaccompanied minors, some of the horrible conditions that we find these young people in, these aren't Trump administration policies. These are policies that were implemented during the Obama administration. So tell us just where we are when we think about the immigration challenges on the border. How much of this is really different from what the Obama administration was doing? How much is just a continuation of policies that had already been set?
It's certainly a mix. The main difference is with the families. The way that these cases were prosecuted across the board in general in times past under the Obama administration was in immigration court, civil court. And in those cases, very often, whoever was charged with entering this country illegally could be released pending future hearings. And there is an open debate over the rate at which those people then return to those hearings. One thing we do know is that those with families have a very high rate of returning for hearings later once they're released into the country. But what's changed now is under the zero tolerance policy, Trump administration is using an option they have, which is to file criminal felony charges against adults entering the country illegally. And when you do that, that triggers automatic separation from a child. It's as if they're being charged with a violent crime and you are protecting the child from this person who's charged with it. This is not something that previous administrations have done, and that's the main difference. Now, when it comes to unaccompanied minors, those who enter on their own, my understanding, and Elise can probably tell us more, is that that policy is pretty much exactly as it has been.
Yeah, I mean, the policies toward them, the unaccompanied minors, are pretty much the same. What you saw under Obama was this massive increase in the number of unaccompanied minors, and the government really wasn't prepared to take that on. Typically, unaccompanied minors are older, usually in their teens. So there's kind of some different challenges there. There are, you know, some stories of, you know, little kids being unaccompanied, but it's mostly kids in their teens. So there are different factors there, but all the same problems apply in terms of having kids in detention, that you're struggling to get sponsors. One way the Trump administration has kind of exacerbated problems is that they're making new requirements about checking the immigration status of everyone in the household for a sponsor. A lot of families living in the U.S. already, maybe if somebody who comes unaccompanied or with a parent, are undocumented. So that can, you know, could serve as a deterrence for people coming forward, and that makes it harder to find sponsors for people. So I think that the unaccompanied minors issue is still really important and something that people aren't paying attention to, but should.
Elise Foley, Lisa Desjardins, thank you both for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Build that wall. Build that wall. Build that wall.
President Trump made it clear from the beginning of his campaign that immigration was a top priority and one that he believes helped get him elected.
They send these people up and they're not sending their finest. Does that sound familiar? Remember I made that speech and I was badly criticized? Oh, what's so terrible what he said? Turned out I was 100% right. That's why I got elected.
And some Republican candidates who are up for election this term are following his lead, running ads in primaries promising to get tough on illegal immigration.
We're going to implement my 287G deportation plan that's going to fill this bus with illegals to send them back to where they came from.
I got a big truck, just in case I need to round up criminal illegals and take them home myself. Yep, I just said that.
But this hasn't always been the Republican message. Soon after the 2012 election, the Republican National Committee, in a document nicknamed the Autopsy, argued that the party was at risk of being permanently locked out of political power unless they won more votes from non-white Americans. One recommendation in that document was to, quote, embrace and champion comprehensive immigration reform. In 2013, a bipartisan immigration package passed the Senate, but that effort failed after the House Republican majority refused to take it up. So how did we get here? How did we get from George W. Bush's compassionate conservatism to Donald Trump's zero tolerance?
I think ultimately we got it wrong from the get-go.
Doug High has held communication positions in the House, Senate, the RNC, as well as serving in George W. Bush's administration. His most recent political role was Deputy Chief of Staff for Communications for House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. And Doug says, ultimately, it's become a zero-sum game.
As we tried to move immigration reform, anytime, whether in the Bush years or after the Bush years, our base always said, wait a second, that is not what we told you to do. That's not what we sent you to Washington, to office, to what have you, to do. And yet we would always try and do it. And that's where we'd fall in trouble with our members.
When you say the base, what do we mean when we say the base? Because I look at the Republican Party and I see multiple factions. The traditional sort of Chamber of Commerce business wing would like to see immigration, especially for more high-skilled immigration or for agriculture having temporary workforce. You see on the issue of DACA, majority of Republicans saying, we support letting these kids stay here, maybe getting legal status. So is it really a base problem or is it a faction problem?
I think it's a base problem and it's a vocal base problem. You know, what you describe with the poll numbers is accurate, but ultimately DACA in the Republican Party is a bit like climate change. You know, a lot of Republicans may say, we need to do something about climate change, we need to do something about DACA, but when they rank it on their top 10 priorities, it's number 11. The reason that we've struggled for years and years to get 218 votes on anything on immigration is because we can't agree within ourselves, much less to then have that conversation with Democrats.
2013 was supposed to be that year, though, because we came out of the 2012 election. The RNC said and did this big deep dive called the autopsy, where they looked into what happened in the 2012 campaign. And their conclusion was, uh-oh, we got to win among non-white voters or else we will lose every national election. The Senate passed a comprehensive immigration bill, and then it never made it to the House. And you were there in the House.
Thanks for reminding me.
I know you love talking about this. So why couldn't the House pass it?
There are a lot of reasons than one basic one. Ultimately, our members and our base didn't want it. But, you know, I remember being in Richmond, Virginia with Eric Cantor on who was my boss at the time, on the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday after the 2012 elections. And he was calling member after member, probably, you know, at least 150 phone calls to members, basically asking, what did you see? What did you hear? What did you learn? And in the days after the 2012 election, this is when even Sean Hannity was saying, we've got a problem with Hispanics. We need to do something on immigration. That's exactly what our members were saying. But as we moved every day further from the 2012 election to their own elections, it became clearer that it wasn't a Florida 6 problem or a Kansas 2 problem. It was an RNC problem. It was a Mitt Romney problem. It wasn't their problem. And what they were hearing from their voters is, as it always has been, what do you mean you're moving immigration? That's not what we elected you to do. In 2013, we were still trying to stop Obamacare. So then let's fast forward to mid-June of 2014, when, you know, my then boss, Eric Cantor, lost by surprise.
He lost his primary.
And immigration was an important part of that. And what Cantor had said basically, you know, for about 6 months was, I want to focus on the kids and find some solution, not necessarily the situation that we're in right now, more DACA-ish. Just let's find a solution for the kids. We don't want to hold parents guilty of crimes that their parents may have committed. That's not what we do in America, et cetera. That reverberated in a negative way, you know, in the party. And so when Eric Cantor lost his primary, any chance of immigration reform was dead on arrival. So again, what are the pressure points with the specific issue of what we're watching, you know, at the border with children right now aside? What are the pressure points to make this happen? I don't see them.
After the 2012 election and throughout the 2016 election, a lot of folks who are longtime Republican strategists were saying this party's doomed. unless we start winning over more non-white voters. Specifically, we got to do better with Latino voters. We have to do better with younger voters. And then Donald Trump wins. And now that conversation seems to have stopped. But is the issue that was raised there, the demographic challenges, still critical for Republicans?
In the short term, no. In the long term, absolutely. One of the things that Donald Trump did, as we know, is he pulled in new voters. And a lot of those new voters were your Dick Gephardt conservative Democrats who have fled the Democrats. So they've made the Democrats on this issue more to the left, and they've moved Republicans even further to the right. It's calcified. Is this sustainable over 2, 6, 8 years, 10 years? Sure. But ultimately, those numbers are going to move to a point that we have a problem in Texas. We're going to have a problem in North Carolina. Give you, you know, one quick anecdote. I was home. I'm from North Carolina. And if you grew up in the Winston-Salem area like I did, the Andy Griffith Show is on every afternoon on local TV. And I'm watching it one time, and they mentioned Siler City, which is a real town, not a fake town like Mayberry. And I thought, I've never been there. I'm going to go to Siler City. And when I got there, I was stunned at the Mercados, the taquerias. Half of the storefronts were Hispanic. That's not what I expected at all. And it was very eye-opening to me. That growth is happening in a lot of pockets in North Carolina. It's still a small part of that population. But here's the thing that we kind of don't like to talk about because it touches in race. Hispanics have babies. White people really don't. And it means that their communities are growing. And that's ultimately going to play itself into, you know, how issues are interpreted and you know, how representation is determined.
So, Doug, looking ahead 4 years, 8 years from now, do you think Republicans have lost the Latino vote?
Yes, and other minority communities as well. The rhetoric that Trump has employed has proactively pushed them away. Now, Hillary Clinton couldn't bring them to the polls, but they're gone for us. And so, you know, we have kind of one model for growth, unfortunately, which is to get kind of older and whiter.
So what would you do if you were a Republican in the post-Trump era, he's no longer president, to win Latino votes? Or are they gone like forever? Like you can't get them back?
There's certainly a generation that is not willing to listen to us. You know, and ultimately, when we have some of these conversations, you know, within the party, your more wonky types will talk about, well, you know, our policies are better for Hispanics because of A, B, and C, which I may agree with, but if they don't want to listen to us and all they hear is, we don't like you, we don't want you even in this country, well, it's hard to talk about how small business tax reform is really going to bring home, you know, the Hispanic vote or the African-American vote or anything else. And I think the challenge that a lot of folks are trying to figure out, as we don't even know what the next 2 or potentially 6 years are going to be anyways, is, you know, we think we know what to do, but we don't know necessarily how to do it or if it can be successful. And, you know, that's been part of my frustration in watching the House of Representatives for not just the past 2 years, but the past 5 years, is I know what needs to be done to fix this. I don't know that it can be done.
So the political incentives are the problem more than anything else?
So one of the problems in the House of Representatives is there's very little incentive for voting yes, and there's no penalty for voting no. So there are no earmarks, and you know, we can argue earmarks good or bad, but those were incentives for yes votes. When I was working for Cantor, we had 4 members who always voted no on everything, and Boehner removed them from their committees. And the conservative outcry on that basically meant they were reinstated the next day, which told everyone there's no penalty here. Even committee chairs vote no from time to time, which should not happen. And that's the same way that the party is kind of writ large. And so I don't know what, in the meantime, can be done to change that.
You and I have talked about this faction in the House called the vote no, but hope yes.
Yes. Right?
So that they
it's a large one. It's
yes,
the largest one.
Meaning they're voting no because they need to do it to give them political cover, but they would really like to see the legislation pass. When I talk to Republicans in the House, if there were a secret ballot on some of these immigration issues, specifically on DACA, mm-hmm. it would pass easily.
Absolutely.
So is it right now what's happening is Republicans are more in the Congress are more fearful of their base than they are committed to their actual position on this issue?
Sure. Politicians want to get reelected. You know, again, the loss of Cantor in his primary sent a very real signal to Republican members of Congress that you don't want to be to the left of Steve King on immigration. well, that hems you in. And even if you're, you know, somebody who maybe feels about it a little differently, that's not reflected in how you're going to vote yes or no. Because ultimately, you can think whatever you think. You're either voting yes or you're voting no.
Republican strategist Doug High. And we've been hearing from supporters of the zero tolerance policy, a lot of folks who are sticking with the president on this one.
This is Dale from Dixon, Kentucky.
Hi, my name is John. I'm calling from Boston.
This is Kurt from Vidalia, Georgia. I don't understand why everyone is blaming the president for the situation on the border when it ultimately it's the parents' fault for breaking the law by crossing illegally.
I don't feel that all these immigrants coming into this blindly. They're kind of doing it through their own children.
I think they're being taken care of. They're being fed. They're given water. They're given shelter, medical care if necessary, which is all more than they deserve.
Immigration has become, in the Trump era, perhaps more than almost any other issue, the dividing line between the two parties.
That's Peter Beinart. He's a contributing editor for The Atlantic and a professor at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. He wrote a piece for The Atlantic in 2017 called How the Democrats Lost Their Way on Immigration. It's hard to believe it now, but not too long ago, the Democratic and Republican positions on immigration were practically reversed.
There's a pretty long history in the United States of the Democratic Party, because it's influenced by the labor movement, of being sympathetic to restrictions on immigration because labor unions thought that more low-skilled immigration would reduce wages. And business, which had more influence in the Republican Party, loving immigration. The Wall Street Journal had a position of actually wanting open borders because the more workers, the better it is for business.
And by 2008, the presidential candidates are pretty closely aligned.
Apprehend those who came here illegally to commit crimes.
We simply cannot allow people to pour into the United States undetected, undocumented.
Obama and McCain's views on immigration in 2008 weren't really that different. So it's been relatively recent. And one of the points that I was trying to make in my Atlantic essay was, I think on the left, there's a tendency to look at the Republican Party and think, wow, they've really gone off a cliff. And I actually think they have gone to a really, really disturbing nativist position, but not to be as aware of the ways in which actually the Democratic Party has also shifted its views on immigration just in the opposite direction.
Well, and your point that you make in the Atlantic piece is that some of this is driven by the fact on the Democrat side that after the election of Barack Obama, there was this belief that demographics were destiny and that the growing Latino population was going to give Democrats sort of a permanent hold on political power.
Yes. And you'll remember, Amy, you know, if you go back to the conversations in the Democratic Party in the 80s and 90s, there was all this anxiety about Democrats losing the white working class. And infamously in places like Macomb County, Michigan. But once Obama won and people started to see the demographic shifts, that was really largely overtaken by the sense of demographic self-confidence, which was powered partly by the young and the fact that they were more Democratic, but partly by the fact that this increasing Latino population was increasingly Democratic. And so from a political point of view, Democrats focused on maintaining that allegiance and support, which pushed them in a more pro-immigration direction, and felt like, well, we don't need to worry so much if maybe this costs us a bit among a white working class that is declining as a share of the population.
But then 2016 happened.
Right. And of course, you know, Donald Trump did not win the popular vote, and there are all kinds of particular anomalies that happened in that election. But the Democratic Party has, in its understandable desire to be on the right side of the rights of immigrants and on the moral side, I think has had a tendency to not sufficiently take account of what are genuine challenges that immigration poses, not because immigrants are not really, really good people and not because we don't want a lot of them in our country, but that actually there are genuine challenges to a society that takes in a lot of immigrants, especially a lot of low-wage immigrants, and that the Democratic Party has had a tendency, I think, to kind of sweep some of those issues under the rug in the last few years.
The Democratic Party has had a real division on this subject.
Now that is Tom Edsel, author and weekly contributor to the New York Times opinion page.
They clearly have a growing Hispanic population that they do not want to alienate by taking any kind of hardline position. But then there are people like Democratic pollster Strayan Greenberg and others who argue that you have to have some kind of policy, basically that the border must work, and that they are going to lose voters, that a lot of the voters throughout the Midwest who cast the key ballots in losing the Electoral College to Trump were driven by immigration. Immigration was a big issue there. Even though there are very few Hispanics in those communities, these are also areas that are losing young white voters who would be most inclined to support immigration. So the result is that the remaining whites are older and most hostile to immigration. They don't like change.
The Democratic Party, and I think I probably fell into this some in my writing too, you know, during the Obama era, came to the view that as the Latino population increased, the Democratic Party, that rising tide would naturally lift the Democratic Party's boat. The problem with that assumption is, as some political scientists have pointed out, it's also possible that as the Latino population increases and anxieties, which are fueled by Fox News and other places about Latinos, increase, that the white population becomes increasingly anti-Latino and more Republican.
To this last theory, Ryan Enos, he's a political researcher at Harvard, he conducted an experiment 6 years ago in parts of Boston that were overwhelmingly liberal and well-off. Using a randomized control trial, he paid Spanish-speaking people to ride commuter trains in these white communities every day at the same time for 2 weeks. He wanted to create the appearance that these Spanish-speaking people had moved into the communities.
Before he conducted this experiment, Enos interviewed people on those platforms, and then he interviewed them afterwards.
Tom Edsel again from the New York Times.
All of them in the first survey were very pro-immigration. In the second survey, the commuters who had been exposed over 2 weeks to these Hispanics suddenly turned anti-immigration. They were no longer loyal liberal Democrats on that issue. And that shows how fragile, basically, this upscale support for Democrats is when you get to the point where, to use the cliche, the rubber hits the road.
So when they thought their neighborhoods were going to have people who were speaking Spanish and thus were probably immigrants, they were more supportive of Republican policies on restricting immigration and on English only and things like that.
Yes, they basically switched to the right on immigration issues.
Enos did another experiment in Chicago that Edsel told me about.
Between 2000 and 2004, they tore down lots of the high-rise public housing. Cabrini Green is probably the most famous of those. Interestingly, some of those huge public housing projects were right next to affluent white neighborhoods, Cabrini Green in particular. What he found was that before, in the 2000 election, the whites who lived in these adjoining areas voted in a more conservative direction by about 10 percentage points than whites in the rest of Chicago. After the public housing projects were no longer there, the whites became more liberal and basically voted the same as all other Chicago whites.
And what is the theory behind that? Why would that be?
It's a theory of racial threat, basically, and that when people fear geographically, by the geographic presence of another, Hispanic or black in this case, that they switch to the right.
So how does the Democratic Party try to reconcile their pro-immigrant ideals with a liberal white base that feels racially threatened? Peter Beinart has some thoughts on that.
I don't think that Democrats have invested enough time, and I think they will need to in the run-up to 2020, in trying to find the right kind of language which emphasizes the benefits of immigration and is embracing of the humanity of immigrants and our need to treat people with dignity, but also responds to anxieties about national unity and anxieties about the strain, the fiscal strain that immigrants can create, especially in certain areas of the country.
So what could that language look like?
There have been some proposals, for instance, that we should levy a particular tax on industries like, let's say, the service industry or the agricultural industry that benefit massively from this very, very low wage, relatively low-skilled immigration, and then basically use that money to help those Americans who may be suffering economically as a result of immigration. That's the kind of discourse and policy that I think might better help Democrats both still support generous immigration policies, but also respond better to the anxieties they create.
Yeah. Though, Peter, especially in this Trump era, the issue seems to me to have been less about economic anxiety than what Trump talks about as crime, drugs, right? The idea that what immigrants are doing isn't simply taking your jobs, but they're bringing and importing violence and drugs.
Yes, which is not true. I mean, one of the problems in some ways is that I think there are challenges that immigration brings. I think that one that Trump has created is almost entirely fictitious. I mean, yeah, sure, you can point to certain Central American gangs that exist, but there's really no good evidence that
I've
seen.
So why do you think he's doing this?
Because it scares people. And because I think especially in the post-9/11 era, there's been this kind of conflation of, you see it in the word border security, kind of the potential threat of violence and terrorism with concerns about immigrants. But I also think Trump is tapping into something deeper, which is the fear of a country that's no longer as cohesive as it was, which is appealing especially among some older white people who imagine the kind of, the America of the 1950s. We're not, and nor should we go back to the America of the 1950s. But I do think one of the things that Democrats can talk more about is the importance of integration and assimilation. And especially if immigrants learning English. Now, immigrants do want to learn English. There's no question about it. But there is some evidence that the rate at which immigrants to the United States are learning English has slowed for a variety of reasons. And I think that would be a really important issue for Democrats to focus on, to try to say we think that it's really crucially important that people who come to the United States learn English and learn English quickly. There's some social science data that suggests that hostility to immigration diminishes a bit as immigrants' English improves. And I think that we need to put more resources into that effort. And I think that would be a way for Democrats kind of to acknowledge some of the kind of anxieties that do exist, not all of which are completely racist and made up, but some of them do have to do with real concerns about how a country that is increasingly diverse, and diversity is a strength, but also maintains its basic unity, which is an old question in American history.
Maybe there are some steps Democrats could take to soften the immigration message for white voters, but how does that play among Latino voters?
This is Lupe from Little Rock, Arkansas. And no, I don't need the current crisis to motivate me to vote. As a naturalized citizen, it is my responsibility to vote in all elections, not just presidential elections. Doing so is my continuous support to speak for those who do not have a voice.
Hi, this is Fernanda Fisher from Lafayette, California. I have to say that I'm completely disgusted with this administration, and I will be voting across the board, Democratic, in the midterms, and I hope everyone else will show up that day because this is critical for our country. And as the daughter of two immigrants, I think we all need to realize what makes this country great.
Those are some of the Latino voters who called us this week in reaction to President Trump's zero tolerance policy. And one key demographic that Democrats are counting on this election are those Latino voters. They're hoping that Latinos who are upset with President Trump's hardline stance on immigration will be motivated to vote Democrat on Election Day. It's also what they relied on in 2016. But
the Latino vote didn't turn out in the numbers people were expecting. If there was a Trump effect, it really didn't seem to show up in some key states.
That's Mark Hugo Lopez, Director of Hispanic Research at the Pew Research Center, and he breaks down the data.
Our surveys prior to the election of the Hispanic population suggested that many Hispanics, by the way, had heard Donald Trump's comments about Mexican immigrants. So there was an awareness of his comments about the population and about particularly Mexican immigrants. However, many Latinos, in fact, half of Hispanic eligible voters, for example, are in two states, California and Texas. Neither one was a battleground state in 2016. As a result, one of the things that's most important for getting Hispanics out to vote, just asking them to vote and doing a lot of get out the vote efforts, weren't focused in those states. So we might expect that in those states, Latino voters didn't turn out in big numbers, partly because they just hadn't been reached out to.
Yeah, it seems like we're in sort of this catch-22 with so many campaigns where they say, well, these voters don't turn out, so we can't spend our resources trying to get them motivated. We should spend much more time on the people we know who are actually consistent voters.
And that's exactly right. And so when you talk about the new number of Latino eligible voters in any given presidential election cycle, it's about 4 million people, many of them young people. And you hear the same story not just about Hispanics, but you also hear about it when it comes to young people, this sense of it's sort of a chicken and an egg problem, which should we do first, or what, how should we invest in them? But they never come out to vote, so why should we invest in them? That's a story you will hear often. And from the side of Hispanics, you'll hear them say, politicians never come talk to us. They really don't seem interested in our communities. They don't really seem interested in us. So it's a little bit of a two-way street as well.
What about how the issue of immigration plays with Hispanic community? It seems that that's all we talk about when we talk about this community and voting. The first thing we say is, well, immigration is the issue that is going to motivate or spur turnout. But do we know that immigration is actually their number one concern?
Well, different polls have shown some different numbers, but certainly the exit poll from 2016 showed that among Latinos who voted in 2016, according to the exit poll, immigration was not the top issue. It was issues like jobs and the economy that was more important to determining the vote of Hispanic voters in 2016. Our own polls we've been doing for the last 10 years have shown that the issue of immigration has not been a top issue either for Latinos or even for the U.S. public, at least up through 2016. Now, I will say that things have changed a little bit in the last 2 years. Immigration has risen as an issue for the U.S. public. There's more interest in this and identifying the issue of immigration as a top priority for Congress and the president to deal with, for example, today than was the case in 2016 among the general U.S. public. Among Latinos, we need to do some surveys to figure out whether or not things have changed among Latinos on this. But it's very possible that for Latino voters, the issue of immigration might be rising some. It did the last time there was a big discussion about immigration back in 07 and 08. It was a little bit higher on the list of issues, but then it fell away with the Great Recession and so forth. However, it generally has not been the top issue, and it usually has followed things like education, jobs, or healthcare as top issues that the Latino population points to.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because when I talk to Democratic and Republican strategists, and they talk about how they're doing outreach to the Hispanic community. For Republicans, they talk about a lot of cultural issues. This is a community of people who are very supportive of our pro-life policies. They're pro-family. They're pro-business, right? That is their sort of cultural DNA. And then for Democrats, they say on immigration, on the rhetoric from Republicans, we are going to win over this Latino vote, rather than focusing on the core economic or other policy challenges that these voters are looking for from the two parties.
The education issue particularly is interesting, because this is a young population which has many of its children in public schools. So for Latinos, the issue of education makes sense. Same thing with healthcare. Many young Latinos are facing high healthcare costs that are perhaps they don't have healthcare through work, or they have to rely on other sources in order to pay for healthcare. It makes sense that that is an issue that would be of concern to the population. On the Republican issues that you outlined, certainly with regard to abortion, Latinos have not moved very much on this, and they're actually split on whether abortion should be legal or illegal in the United States. Foreign-born Hispanics are more likely to say abortion should be illegal in all or most cases, while the U.S.-borns are more likely to say it should be legal in all or most cases. On the issue, though, of gay marriage, interestingly enough, the Hispanic population has moved, just like the U.S. population, towards being in support of gay marriage. So it depends on the issue, but on some of these cultural issues, Latinos have moved. On others, they haven't. And then, of course, when it comes to Republicans and the way Republicans talk about Hispanics and the Hispanic population, Trump's comments about Hispanics, looking at 2016 is a pretty good experiment for seeing how the Hispanic vote responded to that particular set of comments. In this case, Latinos did turn out in record numbers, but their voter turnout rate fell, so it was sort of a mixed story on the Hispanic vote in 2016.
That's Mark Hugo Lopez, Director of Hispanic Research at the Pew Research Center. In many ways, it feels like we've been here before. Donald Trump, as president or as a candidate for president, says or does something that's immediately met with overwhelming negative reactions. His claim that the judge hearing the case about Trump University was unable to be impartial because he was Mexican. His both sides remarks after Charlottesville. And of course, the grab them by the, you know, on the Access Hollywood tape. But soon the furor dies down and the media attention moves elsewhere, usually to something else that Trump has said or done. Those who support the president defend him as someone who speaks his mind and isn't bound by political correctness. Others cringe at his language but see it as bluster without real-world consequence. But here's what's different. For the first time, the president's language can't be separated from his policy. His harsh rhetoric on immigration is no longer theoretical. This is what the term zero tolerance looks like in practice. So will this week be a tipping point for voters? Could this be, as conservative commentator Hugh Hewitt posited, the president's new Katrina? Or will the media and the outrage soon move to another topic? Has it seared into the American conscience or just grazed it? And what will Democrats do with the issue come this fall? They too have struggled to defend and define their version of immigration reform, with many worrying that they'd alienate the white voters they need to win. That's my take. What's yours? You can always find us on Facebook and leave us a comment there. Of course, you can call us with anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway, or you can send it to me at Amy E. Walter. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Amy Walter. This is The Takeaway.